Well, what brings you to the Bay Area at this particular time, Dr. Larry?
Of course, I'm an old Bay Area resident. I still own a home, as a matter of fact, in Berkeley, so I consider that when I come back here, I'm not completely a visitor. The reason I'm coming right now is January 27th and 28th, we are going to bring our psychedelic religious celebration to Berkeley and San Francisco.
Well, now, what would that mean?
Well,
it's referred to, I believe, as a concert.
Oh, no.
Isn't it?
No.
Well, somebody used that phrase in describing it, and I wonder what that could mean.
Well, let me backtrack a bit to put this in context. As you probably know, 3 months ago, we formed a new religion called League for Spiritual Discovery. Like every other religion, we have our own sacramental methods and our own goals. And we practice the religion in small groups privately. But like other religious groups, we have our public educational and demonstration ceremonies, which we call celebrations.
And the private ones are the esoteric side of the situation,
yes.
I gather. And the public ones are, as all religions have been, translated for the masses.
Or not so much the masses as the non-initiated or the non-communicants. This, of course, is the... This may sound strange to Americans, but actually it's the most orthodox form of religion. And indeed, it's not that much different from the way that, for example, the Catholic Church or the Jewish religion operates. You have your sacramental services, which are reserved to the communicants, and then you present to the public what your aspirations are, and you try to show people what you're discovering. So for the last 3 months in New York City, every Tuesday night we've been running what we call psychedelic religious celebrations.
Could you tell me something about them in more detail? I think there are a number of people in our audience who have some concept of what the psychedelic experience is, and I'd like you to speak fairly directly to what you do.
Yes, well, thousands of years men have been having what we now call psychedelic experiences, mystics, visionaries, far-out artists and poets. And after you have this experience, you struggle, you hunger to communicate it, mainly, of course, for yourself. It's a way of reminding yourself what it was, but also to communicate to your fellow men. We think that every religious group in its origin struggled to start a new art. And indeed, you can test the validity of any new religion by the art that it creates, because words, after all, are a fragile freight for carrying the deepest impulses of man. So like other religions in the past, we have developed our own art form. Rather, it is automatically developed. Psychedelic art is the public face or the communication device of our new religion. Now, what is psychedelic art? Psychedelic art is multi-energy. Instead of using one form of light or of movie or of slides, we'll have up to 26 slide projectors and motion picture cameras or projectors going on one huge cinemascope screen. The screen is undulating with cellular forms and changing patterns, stroboscopic flashes, and swimming in and out of this Niagara of visual material are what we call mythic forms. It's as though your own protein memory banks, your genetic code, is being decoded, and these millions of file cards that have been stored for thousands of years begin to flash. Each week in our celebration, we reenact or we renew one of the great ancient religious stories. We've just finished doing the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. In the present time, we're doing the illumination of the Buddha. These great religious figures of the past are men who have been turned on and who have worked out a new metaphor for stating the divine plan or the way things are. And we seek to use modern methods, electronic and multimedia, to turn on the audience, literally.
Do you use sound?
Oh, yes. We use up to 6 or 8 sources of sound. Some live and some tapes. We'll have 4 or 5 tapes going at one time, for example.
Well, now, what is the net result of this in terms of what you expect the members of your audience to do? Is this to encourage them to use LSD, or is it to encourage them to reach some kind of expanded level of awareness without such use? Because whether or not psychedelic aids were invoked, it is obviously true that all the great religious teachers were aware in a quite different way of the reality around them than the average human being.
They had altered perception.
Is this something you simply want people to accept as being a fact? Is it something you feel all people should experience? What, you know, what? How? What's the implementation here?
Well, as I said before, the aims and goals of our religion are highly orthodox. We seek to find the divinity within, call that what you will. But it's been well known for thousands of years that man can focus his microscope inside and turn on to energies and revelations which are built into your nervous system and your cells. Your body is an instrument of communication which has been around for 2 billion years, and there's a lot to learn from it. Now, we don't want other people necessarily to use our sacraments, LSD and marijuana. We're not advocating the use of these. And in our celebrations, which we'll be putting on January 27th and 28th here in the Bay Area, there'll be no attempt to urge people to use drugs. We are attempting to get people to turn inside, to look within, and to turn on. And we don't care what sacrament people use. Throughout human history, the human race has used the most incredible variety of techniques for turning on. They've used flagellation and dance. They've used immobility, solitude, noise,
meditation.
Exactly, meditation, fasting, sacramental foods. The interesting thing is that man's attempt to turn on just staggers imagination. It's hardly anything that hasn't been used one time or another in one culture or another to get this experience. And often the most obvious opposite things have been used. It's well known that overstimulation and noise and crowds is one way of flipping you out of your external mind within. On the other hand, silence and silence.
Mobs, in other
Mobs,
words.
Mobs, yes, or chanting, or you get a large group together and you get a kind of a hypnotic effect. Sexual renunciation is one method. On the other hand, ritual use of sex, where the mates become gods and goddesses for each other, is another. Of course, throughout human history, men have used chemicals, plants, vines, roots. Wine itself was originally a sacramental method of turning people on. So we don't care what method people use. We treasure and glorify any method that can get you high, that is, can turn you on. But we also insist that no one tell us we can't use our sacrament if it seems to work for us.
Well, now, there are a number of aspects of this that I would like to ask some fairly frank questions about. I have heard it stated, and with some understanding, that some of the people who become involved with the use of LSD, that it becomes a sort of dead end. In other words, here is an experience which is highly stimulating and extremely exciting in the deepest sense of the word. And the repetition of that experience, the sort of going off in a corner, as it were, mentally and spiritually, becomes some kind of an end in itself. I've heard it stated that quite a number of creative people, for example, who have gotten into this, no longer produce. Now, I'm going to pose a theory, namely that the proper use of such awareness is bound up with what you bring back.
Absolutely.
And implement in the society around you, and that it, as everything can be abused, so could these methods of hyper-awareness be abused, and in fact have been abused, because I presume that black magic is exactly using the same powers. And I have the idea that no one creates, either in their life or in any visual outward sense, without submitting themselves to some kind of discipline, either their own or some higher discipline to which they are prepared to submit. Now, where along this line does the creative, in sense of our society, in sense of the world that we live in, how do you tie this all in?
Well, you've raised several points, and I find myself in complete agreement with each point as I followed what you just said. Number one, the internal experience cannot be the final goal. Of course, monastics and people in my profession, shamans and alchemists and people who have attempted to change consciousness for thousands of years have debated this point. As a matter of fact, in Southeast Asia, there are two schools of Buddhism. Northern Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, says exactly what you've just said. It's one thing to turn on, but then you've got to come back to society and make it show in your behavior. There's another school of Buddhism, as most of your listeners probably know, Southern Buddhism, which says, no, just stay high all the time. Anything is a trap in the way of going back to society. Well, we belong to the school which believes that by your fruits you shall be known. It's inconceivable to us that people could take LSD regularly and not be driven to come back to society and to try to glorify or to express what they have learned.
And what is it that you think they have learned?
Well, it's highly individual, obviously. And of course, you mentioned the misuse of LSD. It's obvious. Every form of energy that man has invented has been misused. I think the auto engine is misused. I think even radio and television is misused by most other stations. It's too much to ask that our new form of energy, which is released by LSD, is going to immediately cause everyone to become an ecstatic and productive saint. On the other hand, all we can do is say over and over again, every lecture and every performance that we give to the public, that discipline and training and a conscientious attempt to express productively is the inevitable result of your LSD experience. And I think that's one of the tragedies, that many people take LSD and are so entranced and delighted by this internal world that they just turn off the external world. And this inevitably leads to tragedy, because you just can't stir up all this energy and get so many ideas flashing without harnessing it up. And if you don't do that, then you get this endless rumination and you get the so-called LSD freakout, where the person is just spinning around in his own mind. The motto of our religion is turn on, tune in, and drop out. Turn on, of course, means contact these internal possibilities. Tune in means harness it back in works of art, in works of beauty, in works of harmony. So I couldn't agree with you more when you make these comments about.
And what's the dropout?
Well, this is an easily misinterpreted phrase. By dropout, we mean drop out of meaningless activities. We don't mean drop out of life. We don't mean drop out of the really meaningful behaviors. We're convinced, and I think it wouldn't be hard to prove my point, that most Americans are involved in a meaningless robot assembly line, a series of activities. They don't really know what they're doing or why they're doing it, but they just are pushed onto this assembly line and off they go. We tell people to drop out. This is the oldest message of visionary prophets, which happens to be my profession. My trade union has always come back to society and said, look, detach yourself from the immediate tribal and be very careful how you spend your time and in what sort of activity you dedicate your energies. So by drop out, we don't mean just to sit around and grow a beard and discuss the ultimates in philosophy. We mean drop out of the meaningless and tune in to the productive. We live For example, in a large estate in upper New York, there are 60 of us who have dropped out of American society. We think we have our own country there. In addition to starting our own religion, we start our own country. And we leave our little plot of land. I consider I'm going back to the planet Earth and to the United States in a friendly message of communication. And we are trying to develop their pilot study of how man can drop out, how Americans can drop out of the robot aspects of our society and tune back into the more basic human activities, which are familial, which are tribal, and which are involved in individual acts of beauty rather than huge mass movements of power and efficiency.
Well, how do you solve the practical side of life? Because one of the things which has always struck me about Western society is that unless you're, well, practically, I guess, unless you're involved with the Catholic Church, no matter how much a human being might wish to devote themselves to the good of the world, there are not very many channels for this, you see. Now, in India, for example, it's quite customary that a person works productively for a certain number of years, and then they simply pack up and disappear into the great sea of life. And somehow or another, their society, however meagerly, is geared to accept this and to do something about the survival of these people, because society feels that these people, in their own odd way, have great value. What do you, supposing anyone were involved in the process of dropping out, what do they do to survive?
Well, there are two ways this has been done throughout human history. One is the way you suggest, and that's not just Indian. See, the Catholic Church, as you point out today,
correct,
supports thousands and thousands of monastics.
And did all during the medieval and the Dark Age period,
exactly,
and so on, and acted without any question as the carrier of the culture.
Yeah.
A culture that practically inevitably would have died without that concentration of power at the given point.
I think you're going to see a return to this tradition in the United States today. Our country is now so affluent, and we have the problem of leisure, that I think that we're going to be able to tolerate in the future more and more Americans dropping out for a limited space of time, perhaps for a longer space of time. It's no longer an economic problem if several million Americans just retire to a life of meditation and contemplation. But that's not...
It wouldn't be if they were accepted by the society.
Yeah.
It would be for the millions of Americans who did it, if they did
tomorrow,
for example.
Well, the Protestant Puritan ethic... You see, it was the Protestant Church which knocked out the monistic tradition. The Protestant Church glorifies work, virtue, and money in the bank. And we're licking that, and that's one of the campaigns we have going to teach Americans that the Protestant ethic just doesn't work anymore, and we're going to have to tolerate more people dropping out and following the spiritual life. But that's not the real central solution that we see. There's a second way in which people have dropped out in the past, and I would cite the men who founded this country, the Pilgrims and the different groups who dropped out of England. They said to the fellows over there, we don't like your establishment and we're going to drop out of it, and they climbed in leaky boats and came over here, and they started their own tribal culture, which is essentially what it was, and they worked hard and they built up their own economic system, and that's how America was founded. We're returning in our little colony in Millbrook to the original American formula. Now, we can't climb in leaky boats and find an island someplace because our globe is no longer open. So we have gone up to upper New York State, and we've done as the Pilgrims have done. We set up our own economic community. We can support ourselves. And surprisingly enough, when you think about it, there are many ways in which small groups who want it, who just can't take this society in its industrial computer sense, can support themselves. Because as our society, in its lemming-like rush to the cities, gets into this mass, you know, urban insanity, there are enormous vacuums and gaps that are left where thoughtful people can move back into the country and make a make a way of life. There's one thing that a machine culture can't do, and they can't really please the senses. It's very hard for a machine-made object to do what works of art are supposed to do, really delight the hands and delight the eye and delight the body. So that in many, each of these groups that drops out of society in the next 5 or 6 years, 10 years, is going to have to work out its own economic method. They're going to have establish a favorable balance of exchange with a larger society. And if you're not competent enough and creative enough to do that, you're not ready to drop out. See, our motto is turn on. You have to get the revelation first. After you've turned on, tune it back in acts of production and beauty, then you're ready to drop out. And if you're not creative enough and free enough, and if your LSD sessions haven't given you enough real meaning that you can do this, then you obviously haven't learned your LSD lesson and you're not ready to drop out.
Well, it still seems to me, observing the scene around me, that there is some danger here, and you have talked about this earlier in this conversation, of people, particularly very young people, who do not perhaps bring enough experience, enough suffering, enough knowledge to this process, where the simple use of LSD could be highly fraught with danger.
Yes, I deplore the social reality of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of high school and college students taking LSD and not knowing what they're opening up. On the other hand, it's also a social reality that they're going to do it. Just like the automobile is here and it can be misused, the kids are going to use alcohol, they're going to use any form of energy around. They are going to use LSD. I see the current younger generation as a transition generation. We gave them a world which was meaningless. They're trying to salvage the best that they can from it. I think we should be very patient with this younger generation. And the only solution, of course, is training and education and preparation, and that's why we're bringing our celebrations to the West Coast. Our celebrations are not entertainments, although we hope they're entertaining. They're mainly didactic. We're trying to show people what the LSD experience is. We're trying to show people how to use it. It's quite didactic in the sense that each celebration takes up different sense organs and different levels of consciousness. At times I get very dry in my sermon explaining to people what they're seeing on the screen. Training and discipline and, of course, suffering is part of any yoga. And I want to say this about LSD. Sometimes people think that LSD is just pure ecstasy. It's not. There's nothing in life that doesn't have the other side to the coin. And as you leave your tribal mind with its narrow limits and open up these other possibilities, there's just as much potentiality for fear as there is for delight. And that's where the training comes in, how to handle the fear and how to not let it bowl you over and how to harness these energies.
You speak repeatedly of the internal experience of LSD, meaning, I presume, the working out within the human being of whatever expansion of consciousness is achieved. But it is also true that this has a very incredible effect on the physical plane and on all of the sensory processes.
That's what I mean by internal. See,
that's why I wanted you to clarify the
Western man has been so deceived by his priests and by his bureaucratic institutional religions. Most of the great gospels and teachings of the past are absolutely correct, except that our priests have externalized them. When Christ said, seek ye the kingdom of heaven, it is within, he meant that literally. It's within your body. The aim of our religion is to ask man to come to his senses. You have to learn how to use your sense organs and how to deal with the energies which inundate the retina of your eye and the delicate membrane of your ear. You have to go out of your mind to come to your senses. You have to learn how to resurrect your body. Christ meant that literally, that that the revelation is in tissue. The revelation is in cell. And this is what we learned from LSD, and we're not inventing an imaginary soul inside. To me, the soul, one aspect of the soul is a genetic code, which is a tiny little strand of protein which has the entire blueprint and memory of 2 billion years of life on this planet. These are the exciting territories that you can get into if you know what you're doing with LSD.
I have always suspected that either the great religious teachers were completely irrelevant, or else what they said was not some kind of pious hope, but in fact an observation of fact.
Exactly. That's something else that most Americans and Westerners don't realize, that the science of consciousness is just as regular, just as lawful, and just as complicated as the science of energies outside. One of the early mottos of my profession was her Hermetic code. It was on the Emerald Tablet of Hermes back in Alexandria. It says, "What is without is within." That's simply reminding us that there's no energy transformation that you find outside around you that isn't recorded in protein historical records inside your body. Even now, when it comes to space exploration, as I have taken LSD and hurtled around inside inner space, there are all sorts of unidentified flying objects in the metaphorical sense that whiz by your projectors. All of the political and all of the scientific problems of the external world have been worked out over and over again by your cells and your tissues, and unless you get into some contact with this, we think that you're really kind of a robot just being pushed around and reacting to external forces.
In what role and at what level of that role do you visualize yourself, Dr. Larry?
Well, I've given a great deal of thought to that. I think, as I read history, and of course in my profession, which is religious teacher or shaman, you have to look back. We have our tradition, just like the physicist knows about Einstein and Bohr and Newton. I have studied the earlier adepts in my profession, which is the changing of consciousness. I don't think we're ever going to have any more holy men or any more messiahs, and I hope we're not going to have any more martyrs. You see, 1,000 years ago, if someone stumbled on a new method of turning on, maybe it was the Buddha over in India, his original method was the sit-down. He sat under that tree and stayed there till the sit-in. He found a method and he came back and he taught it. Well, by the time that method and that the name of the Buddha reached the Mediterranean, it was maybe 100 years. Slave galleys and folk singers, and it's always the young and the lower class and the alienated that carry the message. By the time it got over the Mediterranean, the Buddha was perhaps 2 or 3 generations dead. So then you set him up as a special person who had a virgin birth or a miraculous death and so forth. That's not true. He was just a human being struggling to find meaning the way the rest of us are. Now, in the present technological age, you see, that's never going to happen. When we announced the formation of our religion in New York 3 months ago at 10 o'clock in the morning, by 10:10 it was on the news ticker in London, and 10:15 it was on the news ticker in Tokyo, and probably 10:17 it was on the news ticker in Beijing, and they were wondering, what are they doing over there now? There's no more room for mythological supernatural religious teachers. I'm simply an American of Irish descent with all of the faults and virtues of my time and culture, struggling for meaning, and we have got a method which works for those people who know how to use it. So that I don't see myself as a historical figure in this old sense. We're not going to have any of these legendary
messiahs.
Yeah, that's right. I think that religion in the future is going to be much more personal. Every man should start his own religion. That's my advice to young people today. Don't think it was all done 2,000 years ago or 500 years ago. The great challenge of human life is really to found your own religion. That means you personally cast off your tribal mind and come to real tissue and fleshly grip with these ancient problems, and you hammer out your own ethical code on your tablets of whatever they are. You become your own Copernicus. You probe these mysteries yourself and come out with your own answers. Now, you're going to come out with pretty much the same answers that Christ and the Buddha came up with, because that's the science of it. There are certain basic truths, but you can't take them in cliche, static form. Nobody can pass on these truths to anyone else, or they're just meaningless formula. You have to have your dark night of the soul. You have to have your LSD flip out. You have to wonder what's real, who am I, and then slowly you're going to have to recapitulate the evolution history of the human race yourself. And that's what the challenge of LSD is. And come out with your own prayers, your own rituals, which work for you and your family and perhaps a few friends. That's the excitement of it. And we deplore the mass conformity of most religions today, which become just like General Motors and NBC television.
You mention repeatedly the universe as being contained within each body. Has your group any attitude about the universe when not contained within a body?
You're asking about immortality. Whenever that question comes up, I know the conversation is getting to a higher and higher level. We're no longer talking about danger and the social problem of one generation of Americans struggling for a new social order.
Well, it can't have failed to occur to you.
Right,
Hillary.
Yeah. That's a good sign that the interview is progressing nicely. You know, we have no answers to the question of immortality. It seems, and of course each person has to work this out himself. I don't think that my body, with my appendectomy and my gold tooth and my graying hair, is going to reappear in a new afterlife. The words of another great member of my profession, St. Thomas, come to mind. He said, "Why do ye ask about the end when you have not found the beginning? If you find the beginning, then you realize that questions about immortality are game questions. They're chessboard questions. Does a tree ask about immortality? Does the honeybee ask those questions? No, because they're tuned in. They know exactly where they came from. They know where they are in the entire process, and they realize that the process goes on, and that immortality is really turning on and locating yourself in this timeless process. Once you've really had this experience, this classic visionary mystic experience, when you're really tuned into the entire picture, you don't worry about immortality anymore. You've had it. You know you're immortal right this second. Even though...
If you are ever going to be.
Right. Even though your body is wearing out and you have to face the fact that the whole universe is going to end. That's the beauty of some of these ancient Indian myths, which make perfect LSD sense. They talk about cycles of history and cycles of evolution. Vishnu goes through all the reincarnations, and then he goes to sleep for several billion years, and then he wakes up again. These are the cycles of nature, of growing and dying, of light and darkness. And there is an immortal sense or a cyclical sense to this, which really satisfies me much more than the notion that my body, with its particular scars and stigmata, will be around again in another circle.
Well, of course, there have been religions which believed that the physical resurrection of the body was not an essential part of this process of immortality. So the gold tooth wouldn't necessarily have to come along
right
with it.
But we certainly believe in the soul, and the closest definition we give to the soul is a genetic code. That's an invisible, ancient, incredibly intelligent blueprinting apparatus with enormous power to spin off bodies the way Detroit assembly lines spin out new models of cars, and which is almost a timeless process. And we literally think that man's nervous system can decode the genetic code. After all, the genetic code produced our nervous system and is in touch with it that way. Why can't we contact it the other way?
Well, in the some of the Eastern religions, at least, the one of the things, if I have understood it, which arises is whether or not the sense of personal identity is maintained throughout this process. And that, I think, is something which causes considerable concern
right.
to many people. And if, again, if I have understood it properly, there is a very widespread school of mystic thought which believes that simply all is one all
yeah.
the time.
Right.
It is just
yeah.
a question of recognizing the interrelatedness of all life, and that this totality
yeah.
is what is the reality, rather than the narrowing down of,
to one,
of the, this particular
century.
Focus
yeah.
point,
yeah.
focal point, which is what you conceive to be you.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's where the science of internal exploration is very convincing once you study the ancient texts. All of the great visionary mystic philosophers, East and West, come up with the same data. That is all one process, and if you can just throw off your tribal mind and participate in this greater flow, you'll see that. Now, see, the embarrassing thing about the human mind is that 99.99% of your nervous system, which is your seat of consciousness, doesn't know that you exist, or doesn't know, in my case, that Timothy Leary exists. Now this
and
is,
couldn't care less.
And couldn't care less with our little problems of ambition and status and so forth. All that they're concerned with is that we keep the universe alive and going. And, of course, we're basically seed carriers from the standpoint of genetic code. We're here to carry on the flame of life. Now, here's where we get into the LSD psychosis or the LSD freakout. For several years now, we have defined... Of course, we think that psychiatry is our modern devil inquisition. Psychiatrists don't know what psychosis is and have no cure for it. Sure, they can load you up with tranquilizers and make you neat and tidy in the back ward, but psychiatry has not come up with the answer to psychosis. But we use this word psychosis the way we use the word devil or devil possession or witchcraft 200, 300, 400, or 500 years ago. Now, the LSD psychosis or the LSD panic, we think, is a religious crisis. And it comes exactly and routinely this way, that the person takes LSD and suddenly discovers that 99% of his nervous system doesn't know or care about him. Then he begins to scream, "Where's Shattuck Avenue? Where's the University of California? Where's Timothy Leary?" And your nervous system is inundating your consciousness with these enigmatic, smiling cellular transformations. Never heard of Timothy Leary. Nope. Never heard of Berkeley. What's all that about? It's the language of tissue in this relentless, beautiful, but inexorable process of life, which is going on inside of you, that becomes frightening. And then people scream, "Get me back, get me back." The tragedy is that the LSD panic today is seen as a psychiatric problem. And of course, the psychiatrist can't deal with a person whose ontological crisis is occurring or whose sense of reality is distorted. You can't use logic to talk to a 2 billion-year-old energy process that's converting things into a cellular flow. The tragedy is that the LSD panic person is dragged off to a mental hospital and treated as a nut. And then this can result in several weeks of confusion and depression and anxiety. Our recommendation is to see the LSD experience as life itself is a religious quest, a religious confrontation, and not as a psychiatric pathological situation.
Well, what will your advice be to these younger people who are experimenting, whether anyone likes it or not, with these forms? Under what circumstances and with what type of help and supervision should they approach what you feel to be a very profound and important experience?
Well, we say prepare yourself for a spiritual experience. find a guru or a spiritual teacher and study with him and have him guide you through your visionary experience. And have your LSD session in a shrine, in a place completely devoted to the spiritual quest. Of course, nobody can do this today because we don't have any gurus and we don't have shrines, and people take LSD in apartments in the North Beach or apartments in Berkeley, which is not the best place to have a mind-rending confrontation. We have, for the last 7 years, been training people in Mexico, in Millbrook, in our summer sessions, and in our psychedelic celebrations, training people how to understand and approach this really awesome experience. When one other thing that I always say when I have a chance to talk to the public is a word to the parents who are concerned about their children. Now, the brute statistical reality is that in an urban center like this, almost every young person is going to be confronted with marijuana or LSD in the next year or two, and a high percentage, which varies from one-third up to two-thirds, depending on the college or the high school, will actually take LSD or marijuana. Now, the tendency of the law enforcement officers is to try to get parents to become policemen, just like Cuba or China or Germany, to get the parents to inform on their kids and to do detective work on their children. This just appalls us. My advice to parents is that you should, what's really scaring you is the breakdown between you and your kids in the way of real honest communication. And instead of swilling your martinis and your cocktails and then calling your kids dope addicts, sit down quietly and ask your youngsters why they're interested in taking marijuana and what they've learned, and find out what other kids are experiencing, and make it a family adventure of study and exploration. And then I say, after 2 or 3 months of this discussion and research and talking to people, if you and your kids think that this is a risk worth taking, do it together. One of the keys to our religious approach, social, is to bring the family back together. And in Millbrook right now, we have about 8 families who are LSD families, who live together, husband, wife, and children. They take LSD together. Bonds of union and communication and family meaning develop, which I think have been lost in much of American institutional life. No government agency is going to solve our spiritual problems. I say to the parents, no government agency is going to stop your children from exploring consciousness. This is your problem of communication and collaboration and mutual understanding with your kids. Sit down and talk to them, and when the time comes, let your kids turn you on. That's my message to the middle-aged, middle-class, whiskey-drinking, suburban American family.
Well, I've heard some of the young people say that when under the influence of marijuana or LSD, that you know, that it's perfectly all right to, for example, careen around, drive a car, and do this kind of thing. What would your response to that be?
Well, that's just ridiculous and inconceivable that anyone would take one of these powerful consciousness-changing chemicals and careen around in bowling alleys or in cars or motorcycles. Sure, if you want to bowl or careen around a car, do it. But the essence of the marijuana or the LSD experience is that you're opening up these internal possibilities. It makes no more sense to me that someone would take LSD and drive a car than on the height of your honeymoon you would be making love in an automobile. Sure, you can do it, but that's a ridiculous waste of a sacred moment. It's just a sign of bad training. People don't know what they're doing, what they're getting into. As a matter of fact, we urge people, of course, I never urge anyone to take LSD or marijuana. That's your last frontier of personal choice, what you do with your nervous system. But if you're going to take LSD or marijuana, select a place that will will tap the highest aesthetic and spiritual possibilities. Never take LSD in a city. Never take LSD in an apartment. Go out to the country and take time. Set up an environment which is beautiful and which will elevate you. And then there'll be no problem of LSD freakouts or anguish in the streets.
Well, now, what do you feel your practical front is like in relation to what you are doing? Do you have difficulty with the authorities in New York, and do you expect further difficulties? What do you feel the attitude?
See, my profession as spiritual teacher with a new sacrament is a risky one. Throughout history, people in my profession are always in a little trouble with the law. As a matter of fact, with the men whom I idolize and model myself after, with no implication I'm comparing myself with these people, but my ideals and my models have all been in jail, at best. The last four presidents of India, for example, have all spent time in jail. So jail to us is not a middle-class disgrace. Here I am, a former Harvard professor. I've been arrested three times in the last year. Isn't that disgraceful? To me, that just means I'm doing my job. And if I don't get the establishment a little worried, I wonder, my message is not getting through. Every time I'm arrested, it gives me a chance to spend a day with the other team. I spend six, 8 hours in jail until I'm bailed out, and I do with the police what I do with everyone else. I discuss with them, I argue with them, they ask questions, I challenge them, and when it's all over and I leave with my lawyer, I usually give them a copy of one of my books and autograph it, and we go back to the playing field to keep it going. This is the ancient dialogue or tension between what it belongs to Caesar and what belongs to the divinity which we locate within. Now, we have a very simple solution or formula to this old problem of Caesar and God. Anything that's outside of your body, anything that moves out there in the streets, property, territory, weapons, money, and so forth, that belongs to Caesar. And you can choose the Caesar you like and vote for him or kill for him if you're led that way. There must be laws, and we certainly agree to obeying Caesar when it comes to secular, tangible, visible activities. But when it comes to anything that goes on inside your body, that's the kingdom of heaven for you. And I cannot let Caesar, whether he's a public health official or a narcotics policeman or one of your two gubernatorial candidates in California, I can't let them tell me what changes I'm going to bring about inside my own body. No one should have anything to say about what touches your body, what goes into it. Now, if taking LSD and marijuana leads me or any of my co-religionists to break any external laws, if we get into automobile accidents, or if we take off our clothes and rush through the streets screaming about the second coming, arrest us for causing a social disorder. You've got plenty of laws in this society to arrest people for behavior. But when it comes to your body and your sense organs and changing consciousness, that's the kingdom of heaven for you, and if you let the law say anything about that, that's a making profane what should be sacred to you. We are now going to court. Our League for Spiritual Discovery has several lawyers, and we are filing suit in the state of New York, which will allow the priests in our religion to import and distribute marijuana LSD only to our communicants in our own shrines.
And that case will be coming up.
That'll be coming up in the next two or three months. Of course, we're asking nothing more there than the Catholic priests and the Jewish rabbis requested of Caesar 40 years ago during that last period of legislative lunacy, which we call alcohol prohibition, when Catholic priests could import and distribute an illegal drug, namely wine, only in their shrines and only to their communicants. Now, the priests didn't give cocktail parties, and when we use LSD and marijuana, we won't be just having turn-on sessions in the streets. And if we do that, take our license away. There's no problem to society here, and the Constitution, wonderfully enough, guarantees this choice of conscience.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larry.